Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness at Long Last. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. As you observe animals, particularly animals in the wild, maybe you're watching some kind of film or you've been able to have some kind of close contact with animals that are still slightly wild, I'm sure it's occurred to you that they may have, their behavior may give you clues to how you should be caring for yourself. I know I've thought this as I watch animals. And after reading the book that my guest today wrote, I'm convinced that this is so. Separated from the sensual qualities of our environment, we humans seldom develop the physical intelligence we need to live life as a craft. Today we explore the specifics about what animals in their native environs do to protect and comfort themselves. You may notice how similar these lessons are to the principles of integrated health. My guest is biologist Cindy Engel. Her book is Wild Health, How Animals Keep Themselves Well and What We Can Learn from Them. Cindy Engel has a doctorate in biology from the University of East Anglia with a concentration on the relationship between physiology and behavior in mammals. She's done research on the behavior and health of wild rabbits and jaguars, and for 12 years has been a lecturer in environmental sciences at the Open University. She's published numerous scientific papers, particularly in the prestigious journal Animal Behavior, and for the past 18 months has worked as a scriptwriter and script advisor for a series of wildlife documentaries being produced by National Geographic. In addition to her research into the medicinal practices of animals, she's studied holistic medicine for humans and is a shiatsu practitioner. She has two children and lives on a farm in Suffolk, England. And I welcome you to the show, Dr. Engel.
Hello there.
Hi. In fact, humans have learned a good deal of their own plant medicine from animals.
Well, that's right. Traditionally, herbalists learned much of their medicinal repertoire, as it were, from observing the behavior of sick animals. And this was quite common right up until the beginning of the last century, even in the West. But, of course, as soon as we discovered germ theory and had the technology to look down the microscope, we took our research into the laboratory rather than out into the field. But we can still find traditional herbalists using this technique of observing what sick animals do in the wild to find new medicines.
Well, and I would say that hunter-gatherer cultures, some of the native cultures that are still available to look at, still use plant medicine that they've learned from animals.
And that's right. I mean, there's a really the most recent one in the book is a story of a herbalist in Africa that is working very close to where the chimpanzee research has been going on. And the herbalist there noticed that a very sick porcupine was eating a very strange plant, strange for the porcupine, that is, and upon a little bit of research discovered lots of new medicinal properties of that plant once it had cured the porcupine. So, yes, it's an ongoing phenomenon. And part of what I was hoping to do by writing Wild Health was to reinvigorate the enthusiasm for observation. Observation is the first tool of a scientific process, and we seem to have forgotten observation. It seems to be the poor man of science at the moment, but I'd like to encourage more of it, actually.
Well, it strikes me also reading your book that you walk a very fine line, because it's easy to, how do I want to say this? There's a way in which the science of observing animals has become, as you say, no longer observatory. You're becoming so clinical that you're disrupting the animal behavior. You may not actually be observing what they normally do. So
yeah. It's
you walk a fine line when you start to walk out of the norm of what scientists. So you're.
And I think it's because observation is always undervalued by scientists.
Clearly.
It seems that, you know, laboratory experimentation is the only reputable part of the process, whereas observation is absolutely vital and a part of the cycle. You know, even during experimentation, you've got to observe and then go back to the original observation and start again quite a lot. And I think people who study animal behaviour quite often get drawn into that process by trying to make their observation more and more invasive, I think, is the word.
Yeah, they're interrupting. It's interesting in this book. I think one of the lessons in this book is that I think people like to identify with animals that eat plant material and tend less, most of the time, to feel close to animals that are predators. And indeed, I think people also believe that the plant world is somehow gentler than the animal world. The animal world is so, you know, we can see that, you know, plants, that animals are killing each other and they even end horrible sort of behavior and they're animals. We even use that term, they're animals.
Yeah.
But plants somehow are on a higher spiritual level. And one of the things that we learn right away in your book is that this isn't actually so, that all life seeks to protect itself and continue living, and it will do that even at the cost of the life of its neighbor. And so you talk about plants being self-protective and even sometimes killing the plants next to them.
That's right. I felt it was very important to dedicate a whole chapter to the ability of plants to harm, because it's the very way that they protect themselves that forms the medicinal pharmacy for the animal world.
Well, and this is a very important point also, because animals, as we will learn during the show, and certainly if people read your book, Wild Health, seek to continue a balance between the properties in plants, the constituents that are poisonous, and those that are medicinal, and how much of the poisons are medicinal, and the balance. And indeed, humans, although they're eating food that is hybridized to remove some of the poisonous effects, actually don't do that so much. Primitive peoples do, so-called primitive, I shouldn't say, I don't find them primitive, but traditional peoples, the better word, native peoples, have always used substances in conjunction with other substances, even as simple as putting lime into corn, various, and preparing them very carefully so that the poisonous substances are mediated in some way. Humans, modern humans, don't do this, and I think that this speaks to some of the dangers sometimes of people becoming vegetarian without studying plant medicine.
That's right. I mean, it is another aspect of the wild knowledge, if you like, that we've lost. We hear quite a lot at the moment in Europe about how we've lost the ability to prepare meat because we've got food poisoning instances increasing dramatically. But as you say, it's the same for, we've lost the knowledge about how to eat safe plant foods. The thing about plants is that they are, apart from the fruits, which they do want animals to eat in order to distribute the fruits, all the rest of the plant will be defended in some way, and usually chemically. And the main thesis of the book is that these defensive toxins are also medicinal, depending on context, depending on dosage and circumstances, and that the way we use the words toxin and medicine need to change, really. They need to be more flexible and context-led.
Well, especially because you can't get away from the medicinal effects of food. It becomes very difficult to separate the idea of medicine and food because they all contain chemicals.
Yeah. the fact that, you know, a compound can be toxic at a certain level is used by certain industries to say that, for example, organic vegetables are not safe because they contain these natural pesticides that to defend the plant, and my point is that it is the very toxicity of them, the very bioactivity of them, that is also the medicinal nature. The fact that a compound is bioactive, that is that it has an effect on living organisms, that effect can be good or bad depending on the amount and the context. And so we've got to get away from this idea that a substance is either a toxin or a medicine.
Well, and in fact, the whole concept of good and bad is tricky yeah. when you're talking yeah. about natural substances because, as you say, there's a balance
yeah.
in the natural environment, and learning that balance would be prudent for us to do.
And learning that balance starts, you know, in the uterus. The fetus is learning what the mother is consuming and what the effect has on the mother from before birth, and the learning process continues, and that's even happening with us still. It's just that what's happening is we have created these super stimuli of high sugar, high salt, high mm-hmm. fat mm-hmm. foods that override all this kind of subtle stimuli that we use that our mammalian systems would usually use to tell whether we were getting the right nutrients.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also fake foods that are not even real foods, damaged fats more than even high fat, I think.
Yeah.
why don't you give us some examples of, before we get into, I mean, in a way I'm sort of asking you to ease into this idea of what animals do mm-hmm. that medicate themselves, but maybe you can explain to us, maybe break down some of these constituents that are in foods that can, you know, some of them are nutrients, some of them are minerals, some of them are medicinal. Maybe you can give us a few examples of how this might work. Or maybe you can just start by explaining what some of these constituents are. You know, you discuss in the book the alkaloids and the tannins.
The secondary compounds. Yeah, there's a whole group of chemicals found in plants that are called secondary compounds because they don't appear to have any primary purpose for the plant at all. And about 200,000 different secondary compounds have been found so far. And there are all sorts of theories as to what they are, ranging from waste products to, being deliberately manufactured to defend the plant. And the oldest group of these, and probably the most well-known to people, are the tannins. If you've ever tasted an unripe acorn, that's very strong tannin. It has an astringent effect. And these compounds were thought to be so old that they defended plants against dinosaurs. And another group that we're familiar with will be the alkaloids. And in there we've got nicotine, which is well known, and caffeine. And a lot of the alkaloids are bitter tasting. And the bitter taste puts off most animal feeders. Mammalian feeders. But the interesting thing about the bitter taste, as it comes up later in the book, is that it looks as if the bitterness is in fact one of the cues, if you like, that is used by animals when they're sick to find the medicines they need, because alkaloids are very strong, powerful bioactive compounds in that they have a huge range of effects on mammalian physiology. Quite a lot of them mimic compounds that are found in the nervous system. So quite a lot of alkaloids will be intoxicating or stimulating, sedating, and have profound effects on pathogens, that is, disease-causing mm-hmm. organisms.
Mm-hmm. It's tannins, incidentally, I think people mostly associate with if you make a very strong cup of black tea. And it makes you pucker. It's so
yeah.
strong it makes you pop your peas into your microphone, probably.
That's right.
But anyway, the other thing that's interesting is that foods contain minerals. You know, these vegetables, mm-hmm. sources of these plants contain minerals, and they're extremely important. The balance of minerals in the body is very important. So that what we're saying here is that animals are attracted to certain tastes in nature based on what they need, you know,
yeah.
the salt, you know, the saltiness of foods, the sodium being so important, for instance, like that. One of the things that we learn here is, you know, I mean, herbalists understand that there are bitter herbs and there are this and there's that
yeah.
and what they do. And they're antiviral or antiparasitic. You know, bitters mm-hmm. are good for digestion and this and
mm-hmm.
that. Animals regularly reduce their toxic and parasitic load. This is something we don't consciously do. People have this odd idea now in the West. They're beginning to hear this word detoxification, and they think this means washing your colon somehow.
Yeah.
And you don't understand that really what we're talking about is boosting liver function, helping the body naturally to remove substances and identify them. And when this doesn't happen well, there are other substances that can help.
That's right. I mean, I have had some queries. I've got a whole chapter in there about how animals eat clay, and all the research appears to be that pointing to the fact that it's most likely to be about binding toxins from plants, because the omnivorous animals and the herbivorous animals need to eat a lot of plant material in order to get all of the nutrients that they need. But with that comes a lot of these defensive compounds. They can't avoid it. So they've got good with the bad. And to help themselves deal with the bad, we've got a huge range of species consuming clay, because clay binds those alkaloid substances that I'm talking about, and then they are excreted out the other end. And the problem comes when we have, as you say, people misunderstanding what the purpose of, say, a clay colon cleanse might be. It isn't this idea that our body is full of toxins,
sort of evil
in
and
some
dirty,
serious manner.
Yeah,
know?
Not supposed to have any bugs in your gut, kind of feeling.
Yeah,
you know, well,
right.
Actually, you know, you can't digest without bugs.
The best research on the clay consumption, which is called geophagy, is performed on groups of macaws who they eat clay every day, come down to the riverbanks in South America and eat great big chunks of clay. And it's been discovered that this clay binds 60% of the alkaloids that they accidentally consume when they're eating seeds. And the seeds, of course, are protected by these very strong defensive compounds, because the plant doesn't want the seeds to be eaten.
Yeah, so it can propagate.
Let
me just say very quickly, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I have by phone in Britain biologist Cindy Engel. Dr. Cindy Engel's book is Wild Health, How Animals Keep Themselves Well and What We Can Learn from Them. The clay eating is really almost universal. It's astonishing. And it's also interesting to note that it looks as though it's mostly the plant-eating animals that need to do this more.
That's
I mean,
right.
Occasionally the meat-eaters do, but the meat-eaters tend to have less of this kind of gastric. The clay is very soothing to the gastric mucosa. And, in fact, people will know clay as kaopectate. You mentioned
That's
this in the book. And kaopectate is a soothing pharmaceutical over-the-counter product that's made from clay. So it's not such an odd idea. There's also incidents that are very interesting of animals, what you call pump priming, taking small samples that raise in order to help their detox pathways. Can you want to explain how that works? Because that's fascinating. It's something we never do, consciously.
Yeah, not consciously. I mean, I'm not suggesting that the animals do it consciously either, but what seems to be happening is that if you have if we talk about an animal like a goat or sheep, research has shown that they can actually pump prime their ability to deal with these plant toxins by nibbling small amounts of them. So, for example, if they're released out into a field that contains plants with defensive alkaloids, at first they can only tolerate a very small amount, but by nibbling a small amount of the plant daily, 3 months later, they can consume three times as much without any detrimental effect on them. And this is quite a well-known physiological mechanism, in that you pump prime the detoxification system in the body by giving it small amounts of toxins. And that's one way that the physiology can adapt, but there's an even more interesting way, an effect that's called hormesis. And this is fascinating, because you only need a very tiny amount of a particular toxin to give a general stimulating effect on the whole metabolism. And no one knows how it works, but and that's probably why it hasn't been discussed fully in the literature, but there are recent papers on hormesis and why it's being ignored, and there are some new ideas suggesting that any kind of threat to the body, any kind of toxicological threat to the body, could stimulate a general metabolic enhancement at these very small doses. And of course, if you're a wild animal sampling a range of plants to find out what is and isn't safe to eat, you're going to be exposing yourself to these hormetic effects all the time. And again, that's something that we're not doing.
Yeah, although, you know, it almost, both pump priming and hormetic effects remind me a little bit of what happens in homeopathy.
Well, the homeopaths have obviously been the most interested in hormesis,
mm-hmm.
As a possible explanation for how homeopathy works.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm talking about here, the hormetic effects, what you've got is a tiny amount of the actual toxin, whereas obviously in homeopathy what you've got is you haven't got any of the original compound there. You've got what I've heard is a kind of water molecule shape template left. You haven't mm-hmm. actually got any of the compound left. So I think it's different, but it may not be dramatically different.
Well, it may be working in a similar, but not exactly.
Yes.
Again, you're right. You're
yes.
talking about something working on what we might call an energetic level.
Yeah.
And the hormetic effect that you're describing is more concrete. I mean, they're actually ingesting small amounts,
amounts,
you know.
That's mm-hmm. it, yes,
yeah.
And getting this general stimulation.
Although I do think that sometimes when people treat themselves with homeopathy, there are new homeopathic remedies out, and I think they actually do have trace amounts of the
right.
substance. So it's possible
yeah.
that they're getting a little bit.
Yes, I'm not a homeopath, so I shouldn't
uh-huh.
say.
Uh-huh. You're more of an herbalist, actually, aren't you? Yeah. Let me just quickly summarize what we just said, because it was a lot of stuff. I think what we started out by explaining to people is that plants attempt to protect themselves, and especially plants that are continue propagation. So, for instance, wild people, hunter and gatherers, really never ate grains. They were mm-hmm. very poisonous. So things that have seeds and that make themselves into other plants, that sprout and create plants, have substances in them. We've known about some of them all along, because they also block some of the mineral balance in our bodies, the phytates and the trypsin and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But in fact, it's in leaves, it's in everything. And even some of these plants even adapt as they're being eaten. So the giraffes eat the tops of the acacia trees, and then the acacia trees start getting more toxic and they have to move on. They get bitter.
Uh-huh.
So they have this thing. And that we, as humans, don't balance things quite the same way. Animals tend to purge their toxic and parasitic load on a regular basis. I'd like to talk more about that in a moment. And then we're also talking about the fact that these things that are food are also medicinal, because they contain not only these self-protective alkaloids and secondary compounds, but they also carry nutrients and minerals. So we're going to take a brief break in a moment. When we come back, I actually want to talk more about this: what animals do to reduce their toxic and parasitic load, because it's fascinating what they do, the leaf eating and all of this sort of stuff. Actually, I think we've got enough time for you to maybe, we've got about 2 minutes, maybe
yeah.
to describe how the monkeys fold the leaves and swallow them, these rough
okay,
leaves.
Well, This is a fascinating story. It's not monkeys, actually. It's chimpanzees, which are apes, and they were seen back in the 1970s to be folding leaves and swallowing them whole, and no one could understand why they were doing it, because these leaves come out the other end totally undigested, and no one could work out why a chimpanzee would want to do that. And when the researchers tried folding and swallowing these leaves themselves, they found that it was like swallowing sandpaper. It was absolutely disgusting. Anyway, 20 years of research ensued trying to find a possible medicinal compound in the leaves, and discovered all sorts of interesting compounds. But in the end, it turned out that the common denominator of all the leaves that are swallowed are that they're very hairy. And it's the hairiness that's important, because when you look at the folded leaves dropped on the forest floor out the other end, they have got nodule worms entrapped and tapeworms entrapped in the hairy folds, and the chimpanzees are using them as a scour to scrape through intestinal worms.
Yeah,
and since that was discovered, its leaf swallowing, as it's called, has also been recorded in gorillas and bonobos, and is widespread throughout Africa.
Yeah.
So it's more than a local phenomenon, and research is going on now to find out how they know how to do it, whether they teach each other, whether they only do it when they feel sick, and so on and so forth.
I've got to take a brief break. We're going to break for about 30 seconds. It's Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman on the phone with biologist Dr. Cindy Engel. Her book is Wild Health, How Animals Keep Themselves Well and What We Can Learn from Them. Stay with us.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever was there will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. We are on the phone with biologist Cindy Engel. Her book is Wild Health, How Animals Keep Themselves Well and What We Can Learn from Them. You do have a website. Can you remind me?
It's animalselfmedication.com, and it's all one word.
Animalselfmedication.com.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And there's a link on there for people to send in any observations they've had or to ask questions, and I'll get back to them.
And if that email went by too fast, you can also just go to your search engine and type in Cindy Engel, E-N-G-E-L, Cindy Engel,
that's
E-N-G-E-L,
right.
And
yeah.
It'll take you there. If you miss parts of today's show and want to get a tape of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can always call my information number at 707-874-2772, 24 hours a day, for information on how to do that. The other issues that come up, along with purging themselves of parasites and bacterial infections, is there are a great deal of issues around safety of food. And it's interesting to note that animals also have an aversion to disease and death, much as our own. They are aware of things being dirty. There's this very touching story in there about a, I think it was a baboon, the female, who had...
She had
a bad case of the runs, and she was trying to get someone to mate with her, and they were all going, ew, no, and they were backing away from her, no, and there was one rather desperate little fellow who just came over and very gently washed off her bottom.
And then proceeded to mate with her.
Well,
yes, it's rather a nice illustration of, you know, quite how...
Not exactly foreplay, but...
How strongly chimpanzees feel about fecal contamination. They don't like it. And they don't like being touched by strangers, because strangers inevitably bring new diseases. And there are quite a lot of examples in the book about how animals actually avoid disease rather than cure it. Because avoidance is always going to be better than curing. And again, you know, this is another lesson that we're coming to again, is to remember how to avoid disease rather than relying on magic bullet drugs to cure everything once we've got it.
Well, except there are two things that come to mind. One is that it explains to me, I'm now living in a forest, why it is that even feral cats, all wild animals, are aversive to being contacted by humans. They sometimes watch you from far away, but they don't want you to touch them.
No.
And I, you know, you always think it's just they're afraid you're going to kill them, but I think you're right that there's an aversion to disease.
I mean, it's being touched by any strange animal, even a member of their own species. You know, if it's someone that isn't in their group, a chimpanzee will not let a strange chimpanzee touch it. because there is this threat of disease, you know, and it's quite simply that those chimpanzees that have been that cautious have survived and the less cautious haven't.
And then I guess the other side of this would be that you have a kind of hygiene hypothesis at the end of the book, that you think that because we've developed these super way, you know, these super sterile sort of lifestyle with all the antibiotics the antifungals and all the antibacterial agents that we're using everywhere and the bleaching and the this and the that, that we, our immune systems actually are becoming more broken down. We have more allergies, we have more autoimmune, you think, because of this?
I don't think it's that. I don't think that they're broken down. I think what it is, and this isn't my idea, this is a collection of, as you say, the hygiene hypothesis that's been put forward by many other researchers, and it is that actually our immune systems are overactive. They're very, very busy, which is why we've got all these autoimmune allergies and so on going on. And the reason that they're overactive in this hypothesis is that they haven't got the work to do that they were designed to do. You know, our immune systems evolved to cope with a constant barrage of parasites and pathogens and toxins and so on and so forth, and as we've just said, you know, we constantly are over sterilizing and over cleansing all of our environment. But of course, we're still exposed to a lot of pathogens and parasites, but nowhere near the load that we used to carry all the time.
That's very interesting, because I have often described autoimmunity as a disease where your immune system is, you have something wrong with, well, anyway, it doesn't know the difference between spinach and cancer. It goes after everything. But the other side of it is that it is true that autoimmune patients often feel better when they have feel better in terms of their allergies or their reactiveness when they've got a cold or a flu.
Yeah, because the immune system gets busy.
It's busy, yeah.
Because most of what feeling ill is about is usually your immune system being busy. You know, can't go into the immunology here, but the immune system secreting all the chemicals that it does to fight the pathogens is what makes you actually feel ill. Rather than the organism itself, rather than the pathogen itself. So, yes, if you can keep your immune system busy. And that's being researched quite heavily at the moment. And what's interesting is that they're finding a lot of autoimmune diseases get better if you inoculate the patient with some kind of deactivated pathogen. Like give them a deactivated dose of tuberculosis. To help with some of the big autoimmune illnesses. So yes, so one of the big lessons that I'm proposing in the book is that in wild health is maintained by it's normal, natural to have low levels of pathogens and parasites in your body all the time, and that, you know, that's how we evolved to be. And if you upset that balance in any way, even by getting rid of them all, you know, then you have to do that at a cost.
Yeah, but this, of course, isn't to say that you don't take normal and natural means to protect yourself from rotted food or...
No.
Yeah, and in fact, animals do have food preparation rituals and stuff.
Yeah, there's a whole section on food preparation and how to avoid unnecessary exposure to pathogens. That's right. I'm trying to say is that we cannot have health simply by removing all pathogens, you know, because that is...
No, because we're symbiotic. We have a symbiotic
relationship. There is this kind of general misunderstanding that you can just kill all pathogens and then you'll be healthy. Well, you won't, because, you know, human mammalian health evolves in a context that is absolutely full of pathogens.
Well, and our gut, you can't digest food without having enough of bacteria in your gut of the right kinds. And even some of it is E. coli, actually, you know, so it's, people get very confused.
Yeah, well, they become good and bad under different contexts.
Exactly. Exactly. It's having enough of their, having something to counter them, having their predators, as you were, you know, in there.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to have things that contest them. Do you want to describe a food preparation ritual of one sort or another, or do you want to give us some examples of what they do?
There's one that I think is rather impressive and involves a tiny little mammal called the pika, and it's about the size of a guinea pig. And what this small mammal does is collect two types of grasses in the autumn, and it stores one type of grass and eats the other. And the type of grass that it stores is very high in phenols, these astringent compounds that include the tannins we talked about earlier. And the clever thing is that if the pika ate these grasses straight away, they would poison him because they're very astringent and would be highly toxic. But because he stores them over the winter, and these phenols gradually degrade, by the time he needs to eat them in the spring, they're ready and they're detoxified and can be consumed in safety. And the clever thing is that the tannins actually preserve the rest of the pika's winter larder as well. So he has a kind of double benefit in that he's degrading the grasses and preserving the rest of his larder with the plant's own chemical defenses, which I think is rather nice.
There's also, aside from specifically food preparation, there's all these wonderful stories about animals doing things like the badgers airing out their bedding.
Yes.
In the sun, which is antiseptic.
Yes, every few days they bring all the dry bedding up into the sunshine and just leave it for a few hours to dry out and then take it down again. And of course, you know, nobody knows for sure why they do it, and it just goes alongside all these other strategies they have, which is that they will never share the same sleeping nest that another badger has had the night before. So they leave a gap of a few days after a badger has slept in one nest before they will go in it. And the same with their own nest. You know, they'll move on after a few days into a different part of the set. And all these strategies are all designed to slow down the spread of all the ectoparasites, that is, all the mites and lice and fleas that bother them so much. And the larvae, the egg larvae that's on the bedding, would dry out, desiccate in the sun when it's brought up into the sunlight.
You know, since you've already gone there, it's kind of interesting to talk a bit about what animals do to try to rid themselves of pests on their skin, although this is a much more difficult thing to do. I mean, we've all seen our cats and dogs rolling in the dust, in the dirt.
Yeah. Well, it's a serious problem if you have fur or feathers, because both those environments are absolutely wonderful for bacteria and ectoparasites, these sort of biting, blood-sucking pests. And so they have to take active measures all the time. And we've seen our animals grooming themselves, cats and dogs grooming, and, you know, it seems on first appearances that they're not having much luck. But if you prevent a dog or a cat from grooming themselves, the number of fleas goes up by 60%. So they are actually being pretty effective. Now, out in the wild, what we see are other strategies, using medicinal strategies. And a lot of mammals will rub very smelly things into their fur if given the opportunity. And so capuchin monkeys have been studied quite extensively. One of their favourites is to take citrus fruits and abrade the peel, because the peel contains the strongest essential oils that are so effective against the skin pests. And then they rub the lemon peel or the citrus peel all over their skin. And there have been various experiments showing that the citrus oil is effective at harming the ectoparasites in the laboratory. But there are going to be other immediate benefits. If you're covered in tiny little bites all over your skin and you rub lemon peel all over it, you get quite a strong reaction if you ever want to try this. But it has an astringent quality as well, so it's very soothing. After the immediate rush of burning sensation, you then get the little bites and sores drying up. So I think there's a more immediate benefit to the animal as well.
Yeah.
And there's another very interesting example of capuchin monkeys, where they will use a very large millipede that secretes a toxic secretion to put off other animals eating it. But this toxic secretion is absolutely wonderful at keeping mosquitoes away, and capuchin monkeys will take the millipedes and rub them to make them secrete this toxin, and then they'll rub that all over their bodies. And they can do this without harming the millipede, and sometimes they'll share, several of them will share one millipede and pass it around and release it and use it again another day. And in the laboratory, this, as I say, this secretion has been found to be highly repellent to mosquitoes and also to kill a large range of bacteria that the monkey's skin would be exposed to.
I had so many sort of silly cartoon-like images come up, you know, where the millipede walks off and says, "I feel so used," you know, that sort of thing, yeah. Right? Or somebody, you know, turning to the other and saying, "Millipede, would you like it a bit?"
Well, at least they keep them alive. Or if they,
yeah, they don't
the birds
them.
That birds do it with ants. They take ants that secrete formic acid and they squirt the, you know, they squeeze the ant in their bill and rub it through their feathers. But unfortunately, the ants don't survive the process.
Yeah, but I recently heard someone say that the total weight of ants in the world is equal to the total weight of humans. So maybe we can spare some, yeah, in weight. And there's also the whole issue of how animals care for themselves when they're ill. Human beings are constantly knocking down something to suppress their symptoms and going on, you know, walking on,
yeah.
Dash. You know, animals sort of, we already know this. They you talked a bit about Peter Levine's research on how animals deal with shock and trauma and how we don't do that and we don't take care of ourselves physically. I've actually interviewed him, but,
I think it's this idea of listening to your body, you know.
Yeah.
That's the major thing, isn't it, really, in that we don't, because we've got to go to work.
Well, also, I don't think we want to appear weak. I mean, one
yeah.
of the things about this business of when you're in shock, trembling mm-hmm. as you come out of it, if you get yeah. hit by a car and somebody's rear-ended you, you get out of the car and you are shaking, but you don't want the other person to see you're shaking because you don't want to appear weak, you know. And you don't think to sit in the car for a minute and allow yourself to just sort of go, okay, we're okay,
yeah.
we're shaking, we're okay. Just a second. All right, now I'm going to kick your ass. But,
yeah.
but you know, we don't allow ourselves that time. But animals have much better techniques for doing that, and they also know what to do when they're poisoned, which is very good. They have much better control over getting poisoned. We tend to try to suppress our symptoms, and actually when you're poisoned, let it out of your system. Let it get out. You know, if you're vomiting, and you know, you are up to a point, unless you're getting so dehydrated, it's dangerous. But, you know, there's animals. We know our cats going out and eating grass and that sort of thing.
Mm. I mean, obviously, they do make mistakes, and there are lots of mistakes that are chronicled in the book. You know, I'm not saying that they are all wise, all-knowing beings, but what I am saying is that they monitor how they feel on a moment-to-moment basis and take appropriate action, because they can't afford to let things slide. You know, whereas we tend to think we can let things slide until, I don't know, next month, next year, you know, until it gets really bad, and then we might go to the doctor. They can't afford to do that. It's life and death situation the whole time, and they've got to be feeling as good as possible at all times because of competitors.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this pressure to be well. It's not just pressure to survive, but pressure to be well, because, as I say in the chapter on injuries, you know, most animals will not show that they are injured because of the vulnerability from a competitor or a predator. So not only has an animal got to be healthy at all times, but it's got to look healthy at all times.
Yeah.
It's part of winning a mate and avoiding predation and so on and so forth. So there's a huge amount of selective pressure on health maintenance behavior. I'm not sure we feel that pressure anymore.
Well, I think there's a little piece of it in not wanting to appear weak. In moment, you don't want to let someone know that you don't feel well or whatever.
Yeah.
And people go to work sick and they're, I'm fine, you know, it's that sort
yeah.
of thing. So I think there's some of that, you know, not
especially
wanting someone to take over your job. You
yeah.
know. Or your girlfriend, or your boyfriend, or something. Mm. Yeah, but animals also learn stuff very early on as they grow. As babies, they're learning about poisons and they're learning about. They have early exposure experiences, which causes an aversive response. And you make a good point that this is a very important point about people who somehow manage to raise a wild animal. Something happens and you have this experience, and then you expect to release this animal into the wild, and the animal really doesn't have.
Doomed.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. It's that there are very, very few cases of successful release and reintroduction. And I think it is mainly to do with the fact that they haven't learned the health maintenance behavior in situ, in the place where they're going to be. And that's becoming more accepted, and a lot of the reintroduction programs at the moment are trying to breed up the endangered species in the environment that they're going to be released in, with the hope that they can better survive.
They should give them a handbook on poisons.
I don't think there is one.
No, I agree.
I was most interested in the chapter on psychological health.
Yeah, I was kind of moving toward that.
Yeah, and it was a debate I had with myself as to whether to include psychological health in it.
I think it's important. I think it's really important. Well, let me ease into it. The first thing I wanted to say about it is that, in terms of psychological, that some of the way that animals know what to do is based on what gives them pleasure, right?
Yeah.
So just like we do. But one of the things they do less than we do is, for instance, sweet food is an energy food. It's meant to be consumed in small amounts, and we just knock down tons of it. You know, they have a tendency to be more balanced about it, although as you pointed out, some animals get a...
Well, I think given the opportunity, they would be exactly the same.
They get a bit alcoholic, for instance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, given exposure to alcohol or fast food high in sugar, they would be in...
They'll go there.
..exactly the same condition as we are. It's just that these things are just not available.
Yeah, I mean, they eat overripe fruit and go on rampages, but they don't have a soft drink machine at their school.
They haven't started brewing it themselves yet.
So to get into the psychological aspects a bit, I'm wondering if you want to talk... the thing that touched me the most was how animals treat each other, and it's the full range.
Mm.
You know, it isn't... I mean, there's an attempt, I think, on our part to believe, as I said about plants, too, that animals are superior to us. I still... think they are in some ways, but I honestly, the whole issue of altruism is very dicey.
Mm.
There are animals that demonstrate altruistic behavior, but it looks like most behavior is based on what's in it for me.
Mm.
And honestly, maybe that's so to some extent with humans too.
Yeah.
But altruism is an interesting issue.
Yes, but even altruistic behavior can stem from strategies which are actually quite selfish at some point. If a strategy such as acknowledging that another individual is in danger and helping them, if that works to protect the group, most of which you are related to, then in terms of inclusive fitness, one is protecting a huge amount of one's genes. It depends how far you want to go down the...
Well, but then we have the elephants that I probably should be teaching us all how to live, you know, who won't harm another... You know, they try very hard unless they're out of their minds for some reason or very angry.
Huh? Who are we talking about?
Elephants.
Elephants, yes.
Yeah, I mean, the wonderful story about the elephant that was helping in a building project, and he would not throw this log down a hole, and they couldn't figure out why, and they looked, and there was a dog asleep at the bottom of the hole. So they don't care whether it's their own species. They're very...
And there are lots of documented cases of biologists being protected by elephants. The one female biologist she was in danger from some... hunters, and the elephants that she was watching surrounded her and protected her, and that's documented in the book. And yes, they are aware of health threats, and that's why those behaviors are in the book, because they are health maintenance behaviors, and they're very generalized in that they are not just at their own relatives, they're not just towards their own species, but they are generalized health maintenance strategies where they'll they acknowledge danger, and they adapt their behavior accordingly.
Elephants also appear to be very emotional too. I mean,
they grieve
terribly for the loss of one of their own or one of their absolutely heartbreaking story of a dying elephant and was it her daughter was trying to get her back up, and she'd been hit by... I mean, it was very difficult to read that.
Yes, it is, and that's only a small extract from the whole story.
Yeah.
It is very... well, we recognize, don't we? That's the trouble, is we kind of recognize the emotion, which is where the scientists start to worry that we're being anthropomorphic and putting our own emotions into the picture. But when you see a mother trying to lift the dead infant while the hunters are still coming towards her, and she's taking the flak from the hunters in order to get her young away, then of course we share an emotional history. You know, the thing about emotions are that they are what trigger behavior. Emotions are, they motivate us, don't they? That's where it comes from, to emote an action. So all animals that have behavior will have some moderation, some modicum, if you like, of emotion, because that's what motivates the behavior. And I think most animal behavior scientists are quite happy with talking about animal emotion nowadays.
I think it's there. And it's interesting, too, that when animals become antisocial, there's usually a reason. And it makes me wonder, of course, too, that there's usually a reason when humans become antisocial, although it's very complex. And so, you know, how much of it is nutrient deficiency, whatever. But I love the story about the elephant, huge elephant seal male who was destroying cars. And it turned out that he was in a very uncomfortable period. It was like he was the equivalent of on the rag. You know, he was sort of... he was going through a sort of uncomfortable molting period or something.
The skin becomes unbearably itchy when he molts.
He was really upset and unhappy.
He's thrashing himself around to try and, cure this unbearable itching. But he just happened to be in a harbour, and he, as he was throwing himself around, he was accidentally sort of smashing up loads of people's new cars and boats and things. So he was in danger of being shot as a violent animal, but of course he was just trying to cure an itch.
Yeah, which may be true of a lot of people who do that kind of stuff. So do you think that we animalize ourselves too, also? Do you think we anthropomorphize animals? Do you think we animalize ourselves?
Well, we are animals.
So. I agree, but it's an interesting thought, you know, do we? Because we do have this self-consciousness, and, I don't know. To me, I'm not sure it's such a good thing that we have it, but we have it.
We obviously have there's something different about Homo sapiens from other animals, otherwise we wouldn't have all this technology and this intellectual ability to alter our environment.
Although maybe we're just like ants.
There is something different about us, but it's not anywhere near as different as I think most people like to imagine.
Yeah, I think I feel the same way, although I think some people would disagree. We've run out of time. I really would like to recommend that people take a look at this book. It's really quite moving. Wild Health, How Animals Keep Themselves Well. You're welcome. And What We Can Learn from Them. Very well written. Very lovely book. Cindy Engel, Engel. Her website, again, is animalselfmedication.com.
Yeah.
Animal Self-Medication. Thank you so much for making yourself available. What is it, like 10 o'clock at night in England?
It is now, yes. Thank you for your interest.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a pleasure, and good luck with your book tour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a cassette copy of this show or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772, 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, you can also go to the website. It's yourownhealthandfitness.com, yourownhealthandfitness.com. Next week, I'll be interviewing epidemiologist Stephen Wing about the study of disease and about how social perspectives, including socioeconomic status, may be predictive in the loss of health. The engineer for your own health and fitness at the Powerhouse Brewery in Sebastopol is George Curtis. And thanks to Johnny Otis and the Powerhouse. At KPFA, I think we have Sally Phillips, and our apologies for our rough start. I'm Lena Berman. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced live by Free Speech Radio. May it live forever, KPFA 94.1 FM, Berkeley, California. I'll be back next week.